The views and opinions expressed by the guests on the following program do not necessarily represent those of Mark Radio, The Shepherd, or its advertisers.
From the studios of The Shepherd Radio Network, it's Afternoons with Mike. This next hour is all about our walk with Jesus, with local pastors, newsmakers, people who are making a difference for the gospel. Now, here is your host, Mike Gilland.
Hey friends, and welcome on this very special edition of Afternoons with Mike. Today is Veterans Day, and it's a very special day to so many people across our country. It should be super special to every citizen of our great land. I am just so grateful for people, both men and women, who have given their lives and are even this very day, at this very moment, serving this great nation in some venue, in some perhaps faraway, distant, foreign land. Others are here in the United States protecting our local interests. I just want to say a big shout out thank you to every veteran that is listening today. And if I could, I'd hug you around the neck right now. But I've done something that is very good. I do believe that you're going to love. I have my favorite veteran on the line right now, Chuck Williams. I used to call him back in the old days, Chaplain Chuck, back when we did some broadcasts in the earlier parts of well, it was actually the last decade, but I've known Chuck Williams for, I guess, close or more than 30 years. Chuck, welcome back to my program.
Thank you very much for having me, Mike.
You know, the last time you and I talked, we talked a lot about the kind of like the new thing at the time. We didn't ever realize it would go as far or as long as it's gone. Then that was the COVID discussion. And during that time, you were, and you still are a student, I might add, but you were actually over the pond and you were in Scotland at that point in time. And we talked about that. You're now stateside. COVID has managed to kind of change the final trajectory of your PhD study. And you're now back in the U.S. So I'm glad to have you a little closer. But boy, you've been through quite the year. Tell us just a little bit about what has happened. We'll start since you retired from the military as major.
Well, I retired from the military in 2018 and had just completed my Doctorate of Ministry Studies in Moral Leadership. And I always really wanted to do a PhD, and I also wanted to prepare myself for the next calling God may have in life. So this way I could pastor, could teach at a university, seminary setting. But also I just wanted to take a more active interest in bestowing upon our church, our culture, our society, our fellow Christians, a little bit of the wisdom God has given me over the decades, and just start engaging in writing ministry. So, but we still need to work on the PhD. We moved to Edinburgh, Scotland in September 2018. First 2 years there were pretty good, well, except for when COVID hit, and it was a bit of a struggle to survive over there. It's very different. They are much more locked down than we were here. We finally managed to get home here for a visit during the summer because our renters had moved out, and what we had discovered was because of the situation, military had put moves on hold. We were not able to secure a renter. We also started to realize just the travel situation, what a mess it is. Mm-hmm. Our flights to come back were canceled 4 times, and we were delayed about 5 weeks. And even when we did get back, our flights were canceled another 3 times by the airline. So we really had to persevere and just try to keep a humble attitude and, you know, not get upset. It is what it is. And we just really relied on God's hand. He's providential. He's behind it. But it really opened our eyes that we think it really probably should be best for us to come back. However, we were willing to make the investment and stay in Scotland, provided that there were several teaching opportunities that were available and I had applied for. I was actually interviewing with one of the colleges there to teach theology. But when COVID hit, those all disappeared. Mm-hmm. Teaching assistantships with the university, the one with the local college, there was even a interim pastoral position. So all of that just disappeared. So you know, in discussions with my wife and my professor, we realized that everything I was doing over there, I could do here. You know, for months I had not even met with my professor. We were meeting over a screen. So, you know, and the bulk of my library was back here. At that time over there, the libraries were not open. There was no research capabilities, you know. So it really became very clear. And I told Celia, I said, you know, I read up on a lot of the history of pandemics, especially the Spanish flu in 1918, and realized that every pandemic has a second and third wave. And so I was just, you know, in prayer before the Lord and just to sense his wisdom of saying now was the time to move back. And boy, we came back just in the nick of time because, you know, the second wave started to kick off. They're closed down again for an entire month. In some ways, their lockdown is more severe than it was the first time. In some ways, it's not. You know, like, for instance, churches. We have a church that had about 300 people, wonderful church in Edinburgh.
Mm-hmm.
But you were only allowed, and this is from the government's guidance, 50 people were allowed to be in the church at any one time.
Mm.
And you had to wear a mask, and there was no singing. There were, you know, there was no Lord's Supper. You know,
that sounds like California right now, Chuck.
Yeah. And when we came back, and this is a sweet part of the story, when we came back for the summer to visit, we went to our local church here, and we had the Lord's Supper the very first day. And my tears came to our eyes. Because we just, you know, we didn't realize how much we had missed the wonderful means of grace of celebrating and proclaiming the Lord's death on the cross. And, you know, for us, that was another thing in the basket of saying, we need to come back. So we went back. We were there for 6 weeks just to pack up, sell everything that we could, and then move back. So, and here we are.
Well, I'm glad you're back. Glad you made it. There's so many people's travel plans were so interrupted and continue to be to some degree, although I think especially in the South here in Florida where we are, things are not certainly not where they were pre-COVID, but we're in phase three here and that's going, I think, very well. And we're praying that this wave that is there. I have heard statistics in different parts of the country where it is still very much a part of the discussion daily. And obviously, you mentioned the spike, the second wave. Do you think there will be a third wave? Would that be next year, according to your research?
Well, a lot of it has to do with whether we have a vaccine or not. How effectual that vaccine is. You know, we have to be careful even with vaccines because they derive the vaccine from the virus itself. That's how they make the vaccine. And even though our technological advances are much greater, the guy I'm studying right now, Jonathan Edwards, he died because of smallpox. He actually volunteered to take the vaccine that they had made at that time. And he was the third president of the College of New Jersey, now Princeton University,
mm-hmm.
and the vaccine actually gave him smallpox.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually a rudimentary type of vaccine. But anyway, you know, we don't know. I mean, if the vaccine is successful, and we certainly hope and trust that it is, that all the positive signs are there, I don't think we'll face a third wave. But, you know, the second and third wave is really going to be, it really all is dependent on human behavior, how we conduct ourselves. You know, the razor's edge we have to walk is we don't have to live in fear of our lives, but we do need to be wise.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking to Chuck Williams right now. Chuck is a veteran. He is a major, retired from the Army, spent a lot of years as a chaplain, and three deployments. Were they all to Afghanistan?
No, Iraq, Afghanistan, and one was to both and other nations.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah, you got around, man. You were everywhere. Well, I tell you, your viewpoint on this comes from one that's not only in the military, but a military person that has spent that much time in deployment. You have experienced perhaps more than the average person what it means to kind of live with a discipline that you may not like. I think everyone who travels in those countries, they're not just as free to go out and do everything that you want to do. And that's what here in America, people are getting a taste for, especially when you look at things like the mask. That continues to be, for many people, a cause of angst, a cause of just irritation. They're not comfortable. But would you still hold and believe that that is a good step forward, Chuck?
I think when you're going into places where there are quite a few people around, I think a mask is just a wise thing. Mm-hmm. You know, social distancing, obviously, because the thing is, you just don't know who has the virus, and you just don't know if you're one of those people who may have something, you know, that will make the infection much worse. I mean, by far and large, most of the people who pass away have pre-existing significant health conditions, or they're elderly and their immune system is low. But there have been other people that have caught it and died. And, you know, we just need to be wise here. That's all. Now, do we wear a mask all the time? No. I mean, when I come out of a Lowe's hardware store, as soon as I break that door, that mask comes off. You know, I do not wear a mask at all times. But I think if you go into a restaurant, you know, obviously when you sit down to eat, take your mask off. We've done that. But Celia and I, just because we're in that older crowd, we generally do take out. We don't eat out. And when we go to a store, we put on a mask while we're in there, and then we take it off. But the other thing is that we're in North Carolina, and there is a state directive that you will wear a mask in all establishments. So, I mean, we don't have a problem with it. We're just trying to be safe. And, you know, even if I contract it, now I'm asymptomatic, I have to worry about giving it to my wife. You know, so, you know, these are just the challenges that we're living. It's a really a different day. It's a significant day. But we also need to look at, you know, as we talked about before, we have to look at what God is trying to communicate to us through this as well, because, you know, he's providential. He is our sovereign God. This virus just didn't pop up and God didn't know about it. So,
yeah, there's a lot of people who would believe that that sense of judgment that many people have alluded to this virus, that God is doing things to get our attention. And a lot of what has been going on in this country that we love, and I am so grateful for America. I trust I always will be thankful. I want that to be the place of my heart to do it. But we also have to realize there are plenty of things going on in America that would not be under the umbrella of God's perfect will or his obedient to his will. And so there is a lot to say that we could be under a sense of the judgment of God because of this thing. And I'm just praying that we can get past this role. And wow, wouldn't it be wonderful if the Lord would heal our land, as we read about in Chronicles? That would be wonderful.
Oh, as Celia and I, we pray that just about every morning when we have breakfast, that verse.
Mm-hmm. 2 Chronicles 7:14, and it is something that we need. It's something that we want. It's something that we are all praying for. Again, today is Veterans Day, and Chuck, how many years did you spend in actual duty, not just deployments, but just time in duty with being as a part of the military?
Just over 21 years.
Wow. Man, that's fantastic. Thank you so much for your service.
Well, thank you.
Let's go back briefly, Chuck, to your earliest years. What was it like back then? You were a young man, and you had entered, I think you spent at least 4 years then, didn't you?
8.
Double that. Okay. Tell me about that one.
Well, I wasn't a Christian when I went in, just a natural-born American heathen. born and raised in New Jersey, a tough guy from the streets there, and I joined and I joined and became a combat engineer. And for most of my time, I became proficient and was kind of like the designated person that did explosives. So it wasn't EOD. We didn't disarm thing. We would employ minefields or use explosives and other type of ways, even booby traps or just creating craters, tank craters, dropping trees. You know, basically a combat engineer in a wartime would either build obstacles or take them out. Or, you know, build ways, like we would build bridges too, you know, to go across some terrain feature that our tanks need to go across. So in many ways, the combat engineer was in between the enemy and the infantry. We were the guys that was in between trying to take out an obstacle that the enemy put in, or we would put one in to stop the enemy or redirect the enemy. But for five of those years, I served in Germany. And at that time, it was West Germany. And it was pretty much the height of the Cold War. Boy, talk about training. And, you know, that's what a military needs to do. I mean, one year I remember, we had went to field exercise. We were in field exercises. We would take a train, load all of our equipment, our armored vehicles, and we would go to a training area called Grafenwehr or Hohenfels. And one year, I think it was about 260 days out of a year. I was single then. We were gone from our people, gone from their families, because the threat was so real from communist Soviet bloc nations.
Mm-hmm.
One time, I was in a field exercise that wasn't in a training area, and we were about 2 kilometers, maybe 3 kilometers from the actual border with East Germany ourselves. And we got a glimpse of it. And you realize, wow, I'm on the world stage here. And when you learned about the GDP or General Defense Plan, you know, this is what we do. You know, if there was an alert, we would take our vehicles and we would go to a pre-positioned spot. And just to get a sense of how, and I'll tie this in later with Veterans Day. My first time there, I was with the 3rd Armored Division in Hanau, Germany, with the 23rd Engineer Battalion. And if a war struck in the Folded Gap area, which, everyone projected it to be, we were going to be the second echelon of defense. The first echelon were those units that were positioned closer to the border. Now, I'm going to throw out a term here, and it sounds, pretty ominous, but, it is what it is, that the life expectancy of the first echelon was less than a minute.
Oh.
Now, life expectancy was this. The moment the enemy fires his first round to where you can expect your first casualty. It could be anyone. It's not saying that everyone in the unit dies. It's just the time you expect your unit, if you're in the first echelon, to experience your first casualty. From the moment the enemy first fired a weapon or whatever. I was never a part of that. I was the closest I was the second echelon. And our life expectancy was 12 minutes.
That doesn't sound great either. My goodness.
Enough time for a prayer.
Yeah, right. That's right.
But it was basically, that's how massive. If the Soviets came across the border, remember, they outnumbered us by huge margins. I mean, all of the allies together, Britain, France, United States, at the height of the Cold War over there in the 80s, we had 10 divisions. The Soviets, I think, had 60.
Mm.
Their divisions were smaller, but they were lined up along the border. But see, that's the communist thing. It's overwhelmed them by superior numbers. That's how they defeated Hitler in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
We depend on technology, tactics, expertise. They just throw mass numbers at you and overwhelmed you till you can't fight. And that was one of the reasons why, if your older listeners will remember, when Reagan came into office, and that's when I was over there, he put the tactical nukes over there, because at one point it was really starting to look like the Soviets just might come across the border.
Mm-hmm.
And Reagan went ahead and put the cruise missile nuke and the Pershing missile nukes in Germany and elsewhere. And it was basically the threat. You come across the border, we launch, first strike, you know. And that really made the Soviets back down. Because, and then within a few years after that, you know, Reagan's strategy worked, because a communistic nation can only survive if it continues to conquer. That's what Hitler had to do. You know, the Nazi party was a socialist party. And so, you know, the threat to Soviets to expand, to conquer new territory, that's just a part of what the communists do. And but when they realized that they were not going to survive World War III in Europe, through, you know, principally through a Folded Gap and elsewhere, eventually that led to the collapse, the economic collapse of the Soviet Union that we saw in 1989 when the Berlin Wall came down.
Mm-hmm. That is fascinating to realize that you were there during one of the most changing and, I guess at the same time, volatile periods of American wartime. Anyone that was alive that saw that wall come down, anyone that knew anything about the Berlin Wall, what it stood for, it was really a tremendous event when that finally happened. And boy, I want to say thank you for being a part of that. Even hearing, you know, we all know that every veteran that's been in war is so dangerous. It's so unpredictable. You get out of war and you're grateful for those that didn't make it. People weren't all that surprised that they didn't, but that doesn't help any of the pain of loss that comes from war. But Chuck, I'm so grateful that for all of your deployments, both before the first time and as a chaplain, God's hand, his providential hand that you mentioned earlier, has been upon your life. So grateful for that. My guest is Chuck Williams. He is a major retired from the Army and spent many years as a chaplain, 21 years in the service altogether. Today is Veterans Day, and we're honoring all veterans by saying a big thank you. And we'll hear more from Chuck and some of his exploits in the Middle East coming in just a moment. This is Afternoons with Mike, and you're in tune to The Shepherd. Back again here on Afternoons with Mike. I've got on the line Chuck Williams. Chuck, I've known you for, like I said, around 30 years or so. And, you know, you were always that kind of friend that, you tower over me. How can I say this nicely? You're a big dude. You're a big man. And I've always felt safe when I had Chuck Williams around. But this big, gigantic, I don't know if you ever played football, but I would not have wanted to have been tackled by you. In fact, I have a distinct remembrance of me playing third base and you were the batter and you shot a rocket down the third baseline one night playing softball that almost ripped my glove off. So that's what I think of you. I think who in the world would want to come up against Chuck Williams in battle? But you were there in battle this last time, not as a warrior with a gun, but as a warrior with the Bible. You were a chaplain. And I'd love for you to tell us the saga on this very special day, this Veterans Day edition of Afternoons with Mike. Tell us the saga of how you went from having a heart for God and ministry and graduating from RTS to feeling the call of reenlisting now as an adult with a degree already and becoming a chaplain. How did that happen?
Well, Mike, I sometimes still had to pinch myself. You know, I had graduated from seminary in 97 and was actually looking to do some other schoolwork. Excuse me. And it's a longer story, but the short of it was that you know, I was manager of the bookstore at RTS.
Mm-hmm.
And I walked today and I saw this Christianity Today magazine, and they had one of these advertisements for an Army chaplain. And, you know, chaplains over the years at RTS, the recruiters would come, and once they heard I had prior service, they would be like, oh, hey, you know, come back in. And, you know, I was just like, talk to the hand. You know, I did my time. I'm too old and all this other stuff. But then I saw that advertisement, and I have seen this advertisement a dozen times. But this time I saw it, and there was a click inside.
Hmm. Now, keep in mind, you had already spent 8 years in the military at that point.
And yeah, and I was out for 17.
Hmm.
So when I felt that click inside, I knew something was up. I was not friendly with God at that point.
What is he saying to you?
I kind of knew what he was saying. And so, you know, I gave it to my pastors to pray about. I said, hey, look, you know, I think I got a hold of some bad pizza or something like that. You know, gave it to my wife to talk about and we pray about. And, you know, and the, both those pastors there in Central Florida, you know, came back about a month or two later. And they were just like, you know, why didn't we think about that as an opportunity for ministry for you, Chuck? And I said, I really don't want to hear that right now.
Mm-hmm.
and Celia said the same thing. And it just, I was just like, Lord, you got to change my heart here. I can't understand how I'm going to go back into the military for 42 years old, you know.
And,
but, you know, the one thing I,
42 years old and facing basic training.
Yeah, well, it was a modified basic training. Obviously, for chaplains, it was not weapons or anything.
I'm so glad to hear that. Good. I feel better for you already.
Yeah, it wasn't a 9-week. It was about a 4-week basic training. But anyway.
That's enough.
But the Lord changed my heart. And I was like, okay, Lord, you know, I'm just going to go ahead and let's do this. And so we actually got an assignment up here to Fort Bragg. And we built a house here, and we still live in it. That's this house here. And, of course, this was in 2005. So this was at the height of the Iraq War. And, you know, they were like, okay, well, you know, you're coming back in, you know, we'll get you settled. You'll probably deploy in about a year, year and a half. Well, scratch that. About a month after we arrived, I got called into a colonel's office, and he told me that a unit had received emergency orders to redeploy, and their chaplain just called it quits. He had just had enough of the deployment, and when a colonel asks you, would you mind going? He's actually telling you you're going to go.
Yeah.
So he asked, you know, would you go for us? And I said, yes, sir, I'll go. And so 2.5 months later, my boots in Iraq.
Wow.
So, and basically just 6 weeks before that, my dad had a massive stroke. And they're in Central Florida. And so before my leaving, 6 weeks before my leaving. And so I, you know, we came down there numerous times. We kind of knew Dad wasn't going to make it through this. He did recover a little bit. He was in a nursing home. And Mike, you know the story too. I was just so honored and privileged to be able to bring my dad to faith in Christ, praying with him. He received Christ on his deathbed. And, you know, this is a man who grew up in the western days of western Pennsylvania. He had a really hard life. His own father abandoned him when he was 2 years old, and he grew up without a father. And there were just other significant abuses in his life. But he just absolutely hated God for a lot of the years that I grew up. And God, you know, and I just told him, said, Dad, you can't holler against God anymore. You know, you're going to meet him. And, but just share the gospel with him, shared what Christ did on the cross with him. And, you know, when I asked him, I mean, he couldn't talk, he can only nod. And I said, Dad, you know, are you ready to receive Jesus Christ and trust in his death on the cross for your sins? And I looked, and there were tears in his eyes. And he managed to mouth the word yes. And I did a double that. I was like, Dad, did you understand me?
Oh, my goodness.
And so we held each other's hand and we prayed. I was in Kuwait for, I deployed 2 weeks later. I was in Kuwait for 2 weeks. And then the day after I landed in Iraq, my dad passed away. So came back to Florida, did the funeral in Wildwood, Florida, and then went back to Iraq and was there for 13 months. For combat purposes, it was probably the most trying time in my life. It was definitely a new experience to get shot at. And to have a couple of IEDs explode right in front of your vehicle. But, it was a rough situation. But thank God we did lose 4 soldiers in our unit. This unit had previously deployed, and in the first 6 months, they lost 18 people.
Mm. By saying that, you mean that was an amazingly low number of casualties.
Amazingly low number. We were convoy security. So we would be in our Humvees, 4 to 5 Humvees. And our job was to protect the convoys of food and fuel going to all the bases in and around Baghdad, including Balad. You always hear that a lot. We went there a lot. And it was all nighttime, you know. So when there was a firefight, you certainly knew it, you know. Every time I was there, we'd have 4 or 5 convoys a day. The average percentage was 70 to 80% of those convoys got into some kind of firefight every night.
Mm.
Every night. So it was a very kinetic environment, as we would call it. Kinetic meaning that, you know, there's a lot of rounds being thrown at you. So it was a very hostile place. So our base was attacked quite a few times. So we had a rocket attack, mortar attack. I think it was the worst year for casualties in Iraq, 2006. But the ministry was great. I think I had led 7 or 8 people to the Lord. I was given a senior pastorate over one of the chapels there. And so, you know, preaching every Sunday. I was a busy guy. I think I worked more during that year than I ever have in my life.
Mm.
And I'm still in touch with many of my soldiers today from that time, 14 years later. Incredible men and women. And that was it. So, came back, and I actually went to airborne school at 44 years old, which was that was crazy as well.
Yeah, now this story is nothing but crazy. Tell about that.
Well, I had always wanted to be a paratrooper, even my first time going in. But, because of the Cold War situation, you know, as an engineer, they just kind of kept you in Europe, you know. Unless you were going to go Special Forces or Ranger or 82nd Airborne, they didn't keep you. They didn't send you to airborne school. But at that time, I think I was the 5th oldest chaplain to go through airborne school. And so that was an incredible experience. Finally got to be a paratrooper. I had wanted to be a paratrooper since I was 14 years old, and I saw the movie A Bridge Too Far. And I kind of knew even then I wanted to be serving in the military. I was always very much proud of my nation, even back then as a teenager. And, you wanted to serve your country. You had a love for your country and you wanted to help defend her. And, a few years later, I was actually in special operations and I did a deployment, to one of the nations in the Middle East. And I would go around to different teams. We had teams in Iraq, Afghanistan, Kuwait, and other nations. And so I would occasionally go and visit them and just check on them and have Bible studies with them and stuff like that, pray with them. And we only lost one person, but the special operations unit I was with, you kind of rarely lost soldiers. It was basically psychological operations, but we did lose one soldier. He was killed by a car bomb. Got to move pretty well. But then I came back here and went to a 6-month school. And then the Army, I tell people jokingly, I got in trouble with the Army because they exiled me to Hawaii.
That would not be a terrible deployment for me. You spent, what, about 3 years there?
Yeah, we went there for 3 years, and in the middle of that, we had a deployment to Afghanistan, and that was another combat deployment. We lost 8 soldiers there. Mm. But we were on a sole base. I was the only chaplain for about 700 green suiters, meaning military, and then we had about another 700-800 civilians who worked there, and we were on the side of a 9,000-10,000-foot mountain. And our job was just to go do the door kickers and fly them in, and there was attacks right outside of our base. It was a pretty hostile environment, but fortunately we had such defense systems on our base, the base itself never got attacked.
Hmm.
But it was close a couple times. You know, they intercepted people who were trying to break through. But I did a lot of flying with my soldiers. We were an assault helicopter unit. I recorded over 70 hours flying with them. Generally, and wisely, my commander certainly would not allow me to be on a combat mission. However, I did end up being on 3 of them. So it was interesting. And so I saw a lot of topography of Afghanistan. How people live in many areas of Afghanistan, Mike, it's almost like in biblical times.
Mm-hmm.
You fly over villages and there is no power, there's no electricity. These people are living, like ancient people did 3,000-4,000 years ago. They raise crops and flocks of sheep and whatever, and that's it.
So young men that go over there on a deployment, they're isolated, number one, from the United States and all of their family, all of the things that are really familiar to them. And then they go to an area like this where there's nothing. There's no technology. There's not even power, like you said. There's a lot of isolation that people, young soldiers, go through. And I can only imagine how important your role would be to those kinds of soldiers.
Yeah, well, on our bases, we did have power. We did have TV.
Oh, of course, in the bases, absolutely.
On the bases.
But these guys are going out on the countryside is just it's just barren and sandy and hot. It was terribly hot.
Well, Iraq was hotter. We were in the south of Iraq. And, Mike, I have the picture of this day. The hottest day we had was August 26, 2006. I'll never forget it. And I had one of those garden thermometers outside of my office. And it actually, the needle was buried in the tip, the little metal thing that's sticking out at the end.
Mm-hmm.
So it recorded 144 degrees.
Oh, goodness.
It could have been hotter because it wouldn't go any further.
Oh.
Now, the worst day over there I had was June 21st. It was just shortly before that, where we were going from our base to a halfway point. We would have to wait till nighttime before we go into Baghdad or through Baghdad. And, here's these up-armored Humvees. We're inside. We've got all of our gear on, our helmets and everything. And windows have to be raised up. And, Mike, even with the air conditioner on, the temperature inside the vehicle would be anywhere between 104 and 112.
Goodness.
But what happened this one day, and I have the picture to prove it, because I had a little digital thermometer. I always carried one with me, is that our air conditioner went out.
Oh.
And we were about 30, maybe 40 minutes out from the base. Now, you can't just stop. Okay, you're not precisely in a war zone, but people have been killed in these regions that we're going through.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't stop because you're in a kill zone. You got a mission. You got to get there by a certain time. And between me and my assistant in the back seat, we had a big cooler. Every vehicle had a cooler. And we always packed about 60, 70, like Gatorades or water. You didn't have soda. You couldn't drink that kind of sugar. And we were just drinking it, everyone. We had the commander of the vehicle, we had the driver, the gunner, The gunner was the only one who stood up out of the vehicle. The rest of us were inside there. And it was, you know, like an oven. It really was. And I remember wringing the neck of the driver in front of me, just trying to keep him cool and rubbing his neck and making sure he's staying away. Because, you know, when you get that hot, you get drowsy. And even pouring water over his head while he's driving. I mean, it's just, we were doing everything we could. And we drank every bottle of water. We were even just passing around the ice that was in the cooler. Because the temperature inside that vehicle recorded 137.2.
That just doesn't seem that it's possible to live with it that hot. I just can't imagine. How long did you have to endure that on that ride?
About 30, 40 minutes.
Oh.
Mike, we would have succumbed if it wasn't for that cooler full of drinks and ice. And when we got to our base, we got out of the vehicle, and as soon as we pulled off our armor, four of us, including myself, four of the five just instantly got sick.
Mm-hmm.
Two of us, not myself, but two others, they had to be IV'd. We radioed ahead, told them what was happening, so they had medics waiting for us. And they kept us there an extra day. And Mike, I woke up the next morning, I was like, every muscle was just, even in my fingers, was aching. I mean, we had basically heat exhaustion.
Yeah, you had to be dehydrated completely.
Oh, clearly so. You know, they gave us this orange juice concoction, and it was, I remember I took a picture of that thermometer inside the vehicle, and I still have it. And when I went back to my commander at our base, I said, so I just want to let you know, I'm from Florida, and putting people in a vehicle like this is called attempted murder down there. And he just laughed. He knew it. Because people do die. We, you know, children, pets, they die in temperatures less than that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was just some of the ordeals that we had to go through. And, you know, for me, though, you know, I told my commander the chaplain's boots need to be right alongside the soldier's boots, even where, you know, if there is an engagement.
Mm-hmm.
That's where soldiers are dying. And, you know, we hope they don't die. We pray they don't die. But a chaplain is a leader. And he needs to be with his troops wherever they are. And so that, you know, I've always had a forward leaning and a foxhole mentality. I didn't want to put myself in a position where I would compromise my soldiers. I had an assistant that was armed. I was not armed. But my job was to be their shepherd there. My job was not to be a trigger puller. And so I just stayed focused that my job is here is to be the representative, the pastor God has called for these soldiers, whether they were Christian or not, but just to bring the word. And we did every convoy. I've got pictures galore. Every convoy, we prayed before that convoy left. We got in a circle, arms around one another. And I would sometimes bring a word of encouragement, devotion, and then we ended up praying. And what was really neat is some of the soldiers, about halfway through the deployment, they would ask Chaplain, can I do the prayer today? And boy, that just warmed my heart. I was just like, absolutely, brother, go for it.
Well, there's this reality, Chuck, that they needed the Lord and probably were much more aware in an environment like that than they ever had been before. So
yeah.
I'm grateful for you enduring the heat of 137 degrees inside a vehicle without air conditioning. That's quite a hot ride right there. I'm glad that you made it through that, and you're back in the United States with us, talking to Major Chuck Williams, retired from the Army, a chaplain for many years, and he's here today as this is a very special edition of Afternoons with Mike, because today is Veterans Day. Thank you to all the veterans out there for serving and keeping our country safe. We are so very grateful. And we're going to be back one more time with Chuck coming up in a moment. This is Afternoons with Mike. Back again one more time with Chuck Williams on the line. Today is Veterans Day. And Chuck, there's a lot of difference between this day and another day that we celebrate the military, and that is Memorial Day. Tell us the difference.
Well, Mike, Veterans Day is the day we honor everyone who has served in all wars. originally Veterans Day was started right after World War One. It was called Armistice Day, which is it still is in the UK, or Remembrance Day, because they remember everyone who served, but primarily World War One, because they lost nearly a million people in that First World War. But then later on, especially after Second World War, Korean War, it was Eisenhower who really led the charge to really make this a day where we pay tribute and honor to all veterans. Memorial Day is the day we remember those who never came back. Now, Veterans Day, here's something I really want to speak to specially, because I think these two people groups who are the unsung heroes of Veterans Day really need to be honored, as well as those who did deploy and go to war. Number one is our families. Mike, I spent 977 days deployed. Celia was more heroic than I was. She would be the one that would have to go to bed each night with the cold bed and often with a wet pillow, just wondering what was happening to her husband. You know, it became a point of fear with a lot of wives, because they would wake up in the morning and look out the window first thing to see if there was a military vehicle in front, because you know what that means. And it was a genuine struggle for them to have to continue their lives while worrying about what's going on with their husband or wives. Our families were there to hold down the fort and to protect our home, our neighborhood, our families. They are so often neglected in the celebration of Veterans Day. But the other people group is are those who served and didn't actually go to war. Mike, no question about it, our nation would have been involved in significant wars if it wasn't for men and women who stood against tyranny and aggression during times when we weren't in war, like the Cold War. I have no doubt that people, men I served with, there would have been a World War III with Russia and the Warsaw Pact back in those days, if men and women in our military did not stand firm against tyranny and aggression. And those veterans need to be honored as well, not just the guys and women, men and women who went to war, but those who served in between the wars. They kept us from further wars. So those are also veterans that need to be honored, thanked, and celebrated today.
You've been through some of the most difficult actual wars in those regions, tumultuous time in Iraq with, you know, we remember back to the regime of Saddam Hussein and all of what was going on back in the war of George Bush Sr. took us through, Desert Storm back in the day. I mean, you were on the heels of all of that in your time, and these are just amazing, amazing milestones for the United States military to have done what they've done and where they are today. So grateful for all of them. Now, having said all that, I want to ask you a question in our time that's remaining here, which is short. Chuck, what concerns, what message, if you could speak to today's military as one who has put 21 years of your life in, what message would you give to those soldiers that are out there today?
Well, for the soldiers, I would say we need to continue to stand firm, continue to foster a love for our country, know why you're there in uniform, understand why you wear that uniform and what the uniform stands for. Make sure you continue to take care of each other, take care of your families, and give yourself wholeheartedly to the matters to which you have been called, which is to be a soldier or sailor or airman or Marine. Focus on your training, being disciplined, being equipped. Pursue spiritual growth. Most of all, from that comes your ethical intelligence, because the bottom line is our military needs to be ready. Now, in terms of our leadership, there is a real need and very troublesome need going on for years now, with the moral demise of our military. Mike, I've got stories to keep you too long with evidence and proof, not conjecture. I actually wrote my first doctorate. The title of my dissertation was The Role of Religious Principles to Restore the Ethical Foundation of a Moral Profession, a Military Profession, Morally Adrift. We're in trouble with our military morally. We truly are.
Yes, we are.
And it is affecting our readiness. So right now, there's been many of warnings, and a lot of it has to do with what's happening in society. I am certainly one of those, and I think I've got sound biblical basis. This is a judgment of God we're going through with COVID. We don't know where it's going to end. We didn't know where it was going to end 6 months ago. But God is being still gracious not to give us a full judgment. You know, we remember from 20, 30 years ago, many of the moral things, immoral things that were going on in our nation. And people were saying, you know, we can't be mocking God like this and everything. Well, guess what? The time has come and God is letting us know in no uncertain terms of his displeasure for us. This is a nation that was founded on the belief of God and the biblical principles that formed and the very basis of principles of our nation. And we have right now gone so far away from that. It really is frightening to think about where can we go next. I want to give a pitch to a book that I just started reading, Rod Dreher. And I'm just in chapter one, and the book is incredible. It's called Live Not by Lies. And what it's talking about is how, especially through this last election, we are becoming a socialistic, communistic nation.
Mm-hmm.
And the book is addressing how those people who lived under the Soviet oppression or the Cuban oppression, they are saying, we've seen this before, you know, but we never thought it would happen now. This local election has terrifying results for us. The immorality that is being espoused by our, you know, projected winner of new president. I mean, just yesterday, I found an interview from just last year with Kamala Harris, and very clearly and explicitly, she is advocating for the legalization of prostitution.
Mm.
You know, in Oregon, they just, you know, decriminalized heroin and cocaine.
Right.
And this creating moral confusion and moral depravity in a nation is what opens the door for the government to step in and take control.
Mm. I want to say thank you so much for being with us today here on the program. Thank you so much for serving the way you have served. And for all that you're doing and the impact that you're going to have on lives going forward, Chuck, because your time's not done. You're doing a great work for the Lord even now. So thank you for being with me today.
Thank you, brother. It has truly been an honor.
And God bless you and God bless all veterans. God bless the United States of America. And friends, thank you for being with me today. We'll catch you next time on Afternoons with Mike.